Today is Thursday, September 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, as President Trump continues focusing on protests and safety issues, Joe Biden turns his campaign focus to the pandemic.
Mr. President, where are you?
We stopped those violent mobs very easily.
German toxicology experts determine Putin critic Alexei Navalny was poisoned.
She said someone tried to silence him.
Also ahead, how TikTok is bringing new comebacks to old musical hits. It's all on today's International Edition. Ignoring local officials' concerns over racial tensions, President Donald Trump on Tuesday visited Kenosha, Wisconsin, the site of violent protests triggered by the shooting of a black man by a white police officer last month, pushing his campaign message of law and order. White House correspondent Patsy Wiedekuswara has this story.
Protests and counter-protests greeted President Donald Trump's visit to Kenosha, Wisconsin, following violent unrest over the police shooting of Jacob Blake on August 23rd. The black man was shot 7 times in the back by a white police officer trying to arrest him. Defying statements from the Kenosha mayor and Wisconsin governor, who say the president's visit will trigger more racial tension, Trump toured a business area burnt down during the unrest.
And we're going to help them a lot. I think we're going to help them a lot.
Trump met with law enforcement, but not the Blake family. He pushed a message of law and order to tamp down months of sometimes violent protests around the country, wading deeper into the debate over racial tension ahead of the November election. This week, Trump suggested that a white teenager accused of fatally shooting 2 people with a semi-automatic weapon during the Kenosha unrest may have acted in self-defense, prompting more criticism, including from Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden.
Fires are burning and we have a president who fans the flames rather than fighting the flames. But we must not burn. We have to build.
Trump blamed Democrats for enabling the violence, which he called domestic terror.
Reckless far-left politicians continue to push the destructive message that our nation and our law enforcement are oppressive or racist.
The president's response to racial unrest is becoming a key election issue, with some research suggesting it may motivate black voters to come to the polls. But despite the Trump campaign's laser focus on law and order, ultimately it may not change many minds. Omar Wasso is a professor of political science at Princeton University, focusing on race and politics.
Support, particularly among whites, for the protest movement has declined somewhat. But in a highly polarized country, Trump's base of support is stable, Biden's base of support is stable, and we're just not seeing that much movement despite news events.
Still, the Trump campaign is making an appeal to white suburban voters concerned by the violence, particularly in swing states such as Wisconsin. Patsy Wiedekuswara, VOA News.
Meanwhile, Joe Biden is now accusing President Trump of turning his back on the coronavirus pandemic and instead focusing on stoking passions in American cities. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
At an event in Wilmington, Delaware, Biden focused on reopening America's schools safely.
This is a national emergency.
But says the Trump administration has no plan.
Mr. President, where are you?
He was in another Wilmington, North Carolina, where he barely mentioned the virus, but instead talked about protests featuring violent mobs, whom he says must be met with force.
These people only know one thing, and that's strength.
A day after the president visited Kenosha, Wisconsin, which is reeling after the police shooting of Jacob Blake, Biden says he'll visit tomorrow. And unlike the president, his campaign says Biden plans to meet with Blake's family. Sagar Magani, Washington.
The federal government has told states to prepare for a coronavirus vaccine to be ready to distribute by November 1st, just a few days before the presidential election. The timeline raising concern among public health experts about a, quote, October surprise, a vaccine approval driven by political considerations ahead of the election rather than science. Meanwhile, Meanwhile, a group of medical professionals laid out a set of guidelines Wednesday for local jurisdictions and poll workers on how to keep in-person voting safe and how voters themselves can minimize their own risk of contracting COVID-19 when voting in the upcoming election. Joining us to talk more about it is Dr. Krutika Kupali, Vice Chair of the Global Health Committee with the Infectious Disease Society of America and also an Assistant Professor of Medicine at the Division of Infectious Diseases at the Medical University of South Carolina. Thank you so much for being with us. Tell us about the guidelines that you are proposing for voting safety.
We outlined a number of things in these guidelines, and some of the highlights of those guidelines that came out were recommendations for polling locations, recommendations for infection control, and recommendations for voters and recommendations for poll workers. And there's some pretty high-level recommendations in there. The most important aspect of these guidelines are going to be making sure that voters and poll workers are wearing masks, maintaining physical distance, and having good hand hygiene. For polling locations, it's going to be making sure they've been relocated to large, well-ventilated areas that can accommodate these measures that we've been talking about. So we've mentioned places like large arenas, school gymnasiums, conference centers, and we really want to try and avoid the local church or senior care facility. So I think those are the really important top line recommendations that we've made in these recommendations.
We've been hearing a lot about vaccines. The White House talking about potentially a vaccine before the election even, but there are now concerns that pushing a vaccine before it's ready, people would be afraid to actually get one. Is it realistic that we could see a fully viable vaccine before the end of the year, before the election? Or would that be something that would be a little bit of unknown as far as its efficacy?
I'm skeptical that we would be able to see a vaccine before the election. That being said, you know, I'm not privy to the data that the Data Safety Monitoring Board is looking at. If they're looking at data and the data looks like the vaccine is much more efficacious than those receiving the placebo, then potentially, but I really think that you would have to show clear benefit. And I think that given the environment that we're in, where there's so much politicalization around the vaccine, there's so much politicalization around the outbreak, I think that approving a vaccine before the election, you'd be very hard pressed to get people to feel like it wasn't a political move at this point. I think you have to have a very high bar in terms of the science to make people feel comfortable.
Well, since we're on the topic of vaccines, the U.S. has just declined to join a group of nations that working in collaboration for a vaccine with the World Health Organization leading that effort. What is your view on the U.S. declining to do it, go its own way?
I think it's a very unfortunate decision. I think that it could have real political repercussions beyond public health. And also, we're taking a real big gamble because if one of the vaccines in that initiative ends up panning out and the one that we're working on doesn't, then we're going to be at a huge loss. So I think this is a poor decision by the United States.
The Trump administration has brought on another person, another doctor, into the coronavirus task force. He apparently has been pushing for a new strategy that includes something called herd immunity. Just basically let everyone get COVID and drive some sort of immunity among the population. There have been a lot of critics of that, though, saying that would cost many lives. Do you agree with that?
I do agree with that. So this physician is not an infectious disease doctor. He's a neuroradiologist, which means that he doesn't have expertise in infectious diseases, virology, immunology. And doing the math, conservative estimates say that to reach herd immunity, you have to have about 65% of the population infected. So that would be 195 million more infections. And if you're looking at the fatality rate, that's about 1% more deaths. So we would be looking at 1.9 million deaths. That would be a huge loss to our population and also a huge burden on our healthcare system. I by no means think that's a good idea for our country or for our population. If we let this herd immunity idea go, as Dr. Atlas is suggesting, we would need to see close to 1.9 or 2 million more deaths happen. That's a significant number of deaths. And, you know, we're still learning about what immunity to coronavirus means. And so, you know, we've been seeing cases pop up here and there of reinfection with COVID. And so we don't even know once you've had it. We know that there's some people who can get it again. I don't think it's a good idea at all. And I think most people in my profession who are infectious disease physicians or have expertise with infectious diseases feel the same way.
Dr. Kritika Kupali, Vice Chair of the Global Health Committee, the Infectious Diseases Society of America, and an Associate Professor of Medicine in the Division of Infectious Diseases at the Medical University of South Carolina. German Chancellor Angela Merkel Wednesday said Russian President Vladimir Putin critic Alexei Navalny, who is intensive care in a Berlin hospital, was poisoned with a Soviet-style nerve agent in what appears to be an attempted murder. Joining us now for the latest is Paris-based journalist Catherine Field. Catherine, I know you've been following this very closely, as are many across Europe and the world. Quite an extraordinary statement on Wednesday by the German leader.
It was an extraordinary intervention by German Chancellor Angela Merkel. She came out, she spoke to the press very briefly, and she confirmed the results of that toxicology test, saying that, yes, a military laboratory in Germany had, in fact, confirmed that it was a Soviet-era nerve agent of the Novichok family that had indeed been had caused the poisoning of opposition politician Alexei Navalny. It was an extraordinary intervention by the German Chancellor. The remarks she made, we don't usually hear from world leaders. She said someone tried to silence him. And in the name of the whole German government, I condemn that in the strongest terms. She also said that she wanted Moscow to have replies. She said she expected a reply from them. She also said that what this poisoning represented was an attack on basic values and rights that everybody should stand for. So for her to say that so publicly showed just the extent to which the German government has now taken this issue on board and is also just widening it. She has said that she will go and speak to other members of the European Union, other leaders of the European Union, to see what can be done about it with them. She's also spoken to the head of NATO. The NATO chief in turn described the poisoning as shocking. So you've been seeing just world leaders suddenly within a few hours of this announcement from Angela Merkel demanding answers, because this examination really did prove that he was poisoned.
And apparently this is a similar type of poison that only the Russian military has, and that was also used on the former Russian spy Sergei Skripal and his daughter that were found unconscious on a park bench in England.
Indeed, this particular nerve agent was developed in the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union, as it was, indeed, it was a similar substance that was found on the door handle of the Skripal's family near Salisbury in southern England. So yes, they do have experience, and they do have, if you like, a record of having used this against people that are considered to be, if you like, a threat to the Kremlin. What was interesting, of course, in this that we discovered was that the German hospital had been in touch with the German military and had asked their specific chemical weapons unit to test for the toxicology. So it was quite interesting that you're now having this link in between a civilian hospital and the military.
There was a lot of speculation at the first hospital that Navalny was rushed to in Siberia, from his supporters saying that Russia was trying to keep him there until whatever toxin was in his body was gone. So when they finally let him go, they must have assumed that it would be out of his system. So if that's the case, obviously, whatever this was, they were able to somehow still pinpoint it.
They are indeed. Also, on Wednesday, we had an announcement from the Berlin hospital giving us more details of the health of Mr. Navalny. They say his health state is still serious. He is still on a ventilator and he's still in intensive care. And they did say that the symptoms from the poisoning are decreasing. Certainly there is still enough of it left in his body that they were able to find traces of. But they did also say in the statement that the long-term consequences of the severe poisoning still cannot be ruled out. They still do not know how much time he was without oxygen, and they certainly do not know what sort of neurological damage permanent neurological damage he has suffered.
Do we know if he's conscious?
No, he is not conscious. He is still in a coma, an induced coma, and for the time being, the hospital in Berlin, the Charité Hospital, is saying that he will remain that way.
Paris-based reporter Catherine Field, thank you so much. U.S. officials say Washington would like to see more Arab and Muslim countries follow the United Arab Emirates' lead in normalizing relations with Israel. It looks to Oman, Bahrain, and Sudan as possible candidates, but Israel's peace partner and staunch Palestinian supporter, Jordan, worries that the Israel-UAE deal will scuttle the two-state solution, and it could possibly be one of the biggest losers if the land for peace option is abandoned. Dale Gavlin Black reports from Amman.
Jordanian analyst Osama El-Sharif, writing on the Al-Monitor website, says Jordan's long-standing political approach to resolving the Palestinian-Israeli conflict could become a minority position. Regional heavyweight Saudi Arabia stands with Jordan and upholds the 2002 Arab Peace Initiative put forward to Israel. It calls for normalized ties in exchange for Israel's full withdrawal from occupied lands, a just settlement for Palestinian refugees, and a Palestinian state with East Jerusalem as its capital. Al-Sharif and analyst Labib Kamhawi warn that peace deals without the Palestinians won't resolve the 72-year-old conflict.
This doesn't come out of conviction in the importance of peace that is based on justice. It will end up very marginal and symbolic normalization, like the way the Egyptian and Jordanian people feel about the Israelis and Israel. It will simply put a crisis on hold, and it will not eliminate it.
The UAE says it still wants a Palestinian state with East Jerusalem as its capital. Gulf Arab nations have increased commercial relations with Israel in recent years and share concerns over Iran. U.S. officials say Washington would like to see more Gulf nations normalize relations with Israel. We don't need to make the sales pitch. Everyone sees the benefits, a senior State Department official said during Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's recent visit to Bahrain. Jordan's foreign minister, Ayman al-Safadi, said the UAE-Israel peace deal should prod Israel to accept a Palestinian state. He warned if this didn't happen, it would only deepen the decades-long Arab-Israeli conflict and threaten the security of the region as a whole. A key U.S. regional ally, Jordan hosts the largest number of Palestinian refugees, numbering 2 million.
Jordan has a lot at stake, and it stands to lose much of its internal security and peace of mind because the majority of Jordanians are of Palestinian origin. And these look at the sanctity of the Palestine issue, something that should be adhered to and respected by all.
Still, Jordanian analyst Amr Sabele says Jordan's 1994 peace treaty with Israel benefits both sides, especially in the security area, and neither side will risk damaging bilateral ties. Jordan's former foreign minister Marwan Muasher said even if other Gulf states follow the UAE's lead, the root issue remains. In the end, it's not the Gulf states who are living under occupation. It's the Palestinians. And until you reach a solution with the Palestinians, it does not matter how many peace deals you make with Arab states, he told Reuters. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
The UN Development Program is warning that the explosion at the port of Beirut in Lebanon has unleashed tons of hazardous waste that pose enormous threats to health and the environment if not disposed of properly. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The prognosis is not good. UN officials say the situation preceding the blast that turned parts of Lebanon's capital city into rubble was already dismal. They say huge quantities of construction and demolition waste were generated when the 2,750 tons of ammonium nitrate stored at the port exploded nearly 1 month ago. Jihan Saoud is program manager of UNDP's Environment and Energy Program in Lebanon. She says the amount of toxic waste discharged by the blast is estimated between 100,000 and 800,000 tons. She says the likely impact of hazardous waste from chemical contamination produced by materials such as pesticides, pharmaceuticals, industrial chemicals, lead, and heavy metals is of great concern.
Chemicals can negatively affect, have a negative effect on health of people that are exposed to them, and can also contaminate the soil and water. Initial reported air pollution from the blast is now considered to be limited. However, chemical contamination of particles that were scattered by the explosion may become airborne again and could pose a public health risk.
Sayed warns marine life also could be contaminated by seeping chemicals if the waste in the port is not contained and treated properly. She says the safe disposal of the toxic waste is a big problem because Lebanon has limited land available for landfilling. She says the country also has no hazardous waste storage or treatment facilities. To make things worse, the UN official says the blast severely damaged one of the two municipal waste facilities in Beirut. She adds the facility that remains is unable to handle the amount of waste being generated.
It's filling up faster, and we already have a potential crisis because of that, because the landfill is reaching its capacity. So this was a pre-existing situation in the country that has only worsened and been compounded by the blast. This is also why the debris and the waste from the blast should not go to the municipal landfills, because there isn't enough room and capacity there. They should be treated separately.
Sayed says the UN and the European Union are working together to ensure that debris removal and waste management is done properly and in an environmentally sound manner. She says the cost of this operation is estimated at more than $100 million. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Refugees seeking new lives in Europe by crossing the eastern Mediterranean to Greece say they are increasingly subject to being robbed, beaten, or even abandoned at sea. Encouraged to make the trip by Turkey, refugees, many from Syria, report they are being expelled by Greek authorities after reaching Greek territory. Athens denies the allegations. We hear more now from VOA's Heather Murdoch in Istanbul.
Since February, VOA has talked to scores of refugees in Turkey who say they have tried but failed to get into Greece. Back then, the Turkish government was openly encouraging them to make the trip, but the Greek government told them not to come. And many refugees reported being beaten, robbed, and then expelled after they arrived. In recent months, the stories have become even more harrowing. Families tell of Greek authorities leaving them at sea on rubber boats without motors or fuel. This is Najma, a 50-year-old single mother with two sons. She and her family were on their third attempt to reach Greece when their boat was stopped and their fuel was seized by what appeared to be Greek security forces. But they were lucky. They say a passenger had enough fuel hidden away to get them back to Turkey. 12-year-old Ibrahim, Najma's son, says at first he wasn't scared. But then, he says, officers began poking the rubber boat with sharp pikes, and people started screaming, afraid the officers would pop the boat. On a previous trip, the refugees said they made it to the Greek islands. But they said they were soon arrested and left on rafts at sea before the Turkish Coast Guard rescued them. Greece has denied any illegal activity, noting that it has rescued tens of thousands of asylum seekers in recent years. The government adds it protects European Union borders vigorously with tough but fair policies. The New York Times recently reported Greece has secretly expelled more than 1,000 people in recent months, abandoning many of them at sea outside of Greek territorial waters. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Istanbul.
The United States said Wednesday that it will not pay some $80 million it currently owes to the Geneva-based World Health Organization and will instead redirect the money to help pay its United Nations bill in New York. The U.S. announced plans to leave the WHO next year after President Trump accused it of becoming a puppet for China during the coronavirus pandemic. The WHO rejected Trump's assertions.
VOA's International Edition continues. Anger is mounting in Mauritius after a Japanese bulk carrier wrecked on its shores in July, spilling an estimated 1,000 tons of oil and diesel into the sea. It's polluting the island nation's world-famous reefs and lagoons, threatening coral and other marine life. Now its former president wants answers from the shipping industry. Amina Gurib Fakim is a biodiversity scientist who spoke to VOA's Haid Adams Fitzpatrick from the Mauritius capital.
Outrage in Port Louis. Mauritians fear an ecological and economic catastrophe is unfolding along their coastline, which many depend on for food and tourism. Africa's so-called paradise on earth is now streaked with oil and diesel as dead dolphins and other fish wash up on shore. The island nation's former president is sounding a global alarm. Amina Gurib Fakim spoke to me from Port Louis.
There appear to be various dimensions of harm here. Can you walk us through the hierarchy of what's worst about this spill?
Number one would be this terrible disaster which is happening to our wildlife. The second one, which is of importance, is the role of the shipping industry to be addressing this, because this is not the first time it's happened and it keeps on happening, and somebody somewhere must put a stop to this. The third one, of course, is the regulators. What is the role of the regulators? Because so far we haven't seen much noise around this. And then the fourth dimension is on the local front. Why did that happen? Why did it take so long for them to react when they knew that there was oil on board, when they had taken 12 days for a reaction to happen from the local players here?
Current President Pravind Jugnauth blames bad weather for his government's slow response, and he denies any wrongdoing. The ship's owners have apologized and say they're open to compensation claims.
Ma'am, what form of compensation and duration of compensation do you think would be acceptable?
This ship was not an oil tanker, because had it been an oil tanker, the compensation would have been straightforward. It was a cargo ship. And we know that cargo ship, the level of compensation is, of course, not the same as for an oil tanker. Who compensate for the loss of the livelihoods of these people? I went to see them. And I could see terror in their eyes, because they could see the livelihoods eroding away in that oils of the Wakashio. They have been out of job now for the past 6 months because of the COVID, which has wiped away 24% of our GDP coming straight from tourism. And now as we start to emerge out of COVID, we see this. So how can we start to imagine the level of compensation that we deserve? And are they going to pay? We make a plea to the G20, because this industry has to be regulated. They have to be held accountable, because it happened now in Mauritius. It happened last month in Beirut. It's about, there's a ticking time bomb just outside Yemen as well. So why should we become victims to this kind of negligence, if I may use the word, because that's what it is? But somebody has to have the courage to speak to the shipping industry, because we know they're a very powerful industry, and might is not right.
Amina Gurib Fakim is a biodiversity scientist speaking with VOA's Haid Adams Fitzpatrick. And thanks to the popularity of TikTok, R&B veteran Ne-Yo's 2007 hit, Because of You, is just the latest throwback single to make a major comeback. The song has now earned between 450 and 500,000 audio streams a week in the U.S. for most of the summer, according to a data provider for Rolling Stone Charts. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. There's just no way you're going to get all the skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
And the AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London on Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour. Whoa. Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews. Ooh. Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border.